Welcome to Real Life Mentoring, where we explore real life issues to help you make an authentic difference in the world.
Hi, it's Chris and Christina, and today we have a special guest, and I could wax eloquent, but Carl, I'm going to let you introduce yourself today.
What'd you say? You could wax eloquent?
I could wax eloquent. It means I could speak real fancy.
Wow.
Have you heard that before?
I'm from Waco, Texas. We don't use that.
I've never heard that statement before. Go ahead, Carl.
I'm trying to zhuzh us up a
little. Okay. Yeah, y'all are a little bit more fancy up here in Oklahoma. Yeah, my name is Carl Gully. I'm from Waco, Texas, born and raised. I often tell people that I was that my mom was like Mother Teresa and my dad was a straight pagan, and how they got married, I don't know. But he was an alcoholic until after I was married. So my whole life was like being in God's presence because my mom's dragging us to church and then go back home to this broken place. So I was a two-sided man. I was a man who loved God and then had all this sin and didn't know how to get out of that. So I did a discipleship school when I graduated from high school, just decided I'm either going to go in all in with Jesus or I'm going all in with the world. And I was the oldest of five boys, so I had carried a lot of pressure on my life to try to hold those guys together. And it was the time where I just said, I need to own my faith. So that was a big game changer for me. And I just said, I want to start pouring into young people as a result of what I found. And so I started doing that, became a youth pastor and a college pastor, kind of went down the ministry route. And next thing you know, I've been married for 25 years, have four kids that are ages 16 to 24, still in Waco, still pouring into people.
What's one challenge that you deal with today, would you say?
Well, I guess learning how to parent adult children has been a big deal. You know, I don't have control over their life anymore. That's hard. I want to tell them what to do. So I am learning how to urge them and walk with them and let them make the choices and let them fall. So that's one challenge I deal with on the parenting side. And on the ministry side, it's interesting because in my job now, I serve a lot of churches, but I don't have authority to tell them what to do. So you end up doing the same kind of thing. You love them, you serve them, and then you let them make the decisions. And so it's basically me learning how to deepen my controllessness. And I'm not great at that. That'd be a challenge.
Well, we had you on here today because we heard you speak recently, and we love that several times we heard the word mentor. Yeah, so-and-so mentored me. As a young person, so-and-so mentored me. Tell us about the role that mentoring has played in your life.
Game changer. My mom, she should have divorced my dad. She didn't have, quote, biblical grounds, but it was just a bad situation. And she had a woman that mentored her. It was a women's Bible study that she went to every Tuesday night. And this woman talked about marriage and family. And I get emotional when I talk about this woman. She just went to be with Jesus a couple years ago. But she, one night, my mom whisked us up and we went to her house. I didn't know what we were there for. But she was there to ask this lady, her name is Mercedes, if she should divorce my dad. And that woman who mentored my mom said, you can. But I feel like God's telling me that if you'll stay with your husband, he's going to give you an inheritance of ministers in your sons, which is different than what she had been told. If you stay with your husband, you're going to raise five alcoholics.
And she had been told that.
She had been told that over and over. If you stay, you're raising five addicts is what you're doing. They're going to follow your dad's lead. So this woman spoke up and said, I think it's the opposite. You'll get five ministers. But you do whatever you want to do. I'm with you. And that was a stake in the ground, and my mom stayed, and my dad's reconciliation and restoration story. And, you know, my mom went to be with Jesus a few years ago, but they had been life group leaders for, small group leaders in a church for 20 years.
Wow.
All of her boys were ministers at one point. That came true. So when I think about mentoring, I think it started there. And then my mom found men to basically be a substitute for my dad. And so my youth pastor, his name was Sean Richmond, he started to pour into me. And he was like, meet every week, ask me about if I'm spending time with God, if I'm having lustful thoughts, if I'm reaching out to other people. It was like the real stuff. And his dad had been alcoholic, so he understood me. He got me. He would come over at 11 o'clock when my dad's passed out or having a rage fest. And he was in my world. But there were other men. I don't know if you ever read Robert Coleman's book about discipleship, but he talks about secondary discipleship, people mm-hmm. that are just, they're not meeting with you every week, but they're in your world. Mm-hmm. And Mom just made sure that there were these men that were in our world that I look back on, and again, I can get emotional thinking about people like Ken Lorenz, who was just the guy that kept finding me every Sunday. I see you. I love you. I believe in you. Mm-hmm. Take me to lunch every once in a while kind of thing. And then when I even started getting closer and closer to ministry, I had some men named Jimmy Seibert and Kevin Johnson and Jeff Bianchi. And these guys just, they would just meet with me and meet with me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel like, I felt like everybody else knew how to do life and I didn't. So I have to work overtime to figure out what everybody else has on lock. And I'm grateful for those men that just basically tried to knock the question marks that were over my head wherever I went and just believe in me and love me. And honestly, the last few years weren't necessarily easy on me. I kind of hit my own, I don't know what you want to call it, dark night of the soul, midlife crisis, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And I had three men that, you know, as you get older, you there's not like a mentor program that 48-year-old guys sign up for all the time.
It's few and far between.
It's few and far between.
It is.
So it's a little bit more like, who do you reach out to? Mm-hmm. And one of those men was a counselor. He started as my counselor, and then he kind of turned into mentor and then friend, but he's still that. Mm. While there was another gentleman that I had reached out to and just said, would you meet with me? And he would meet with me once a month and just pour into me. And I respected him so much. When I was at low places, I needed him. I needed him to, because I respected him, and he knew my junk. So a lot of people, especially if you're a pastor or you're a speaker, they hear you and they become very impressed by you, but they don't know you. Mm-hmm. So that good sermon, you're an amazing preacher, you're my favorite, it wears out pretty quick. Because what you're thinking is, yeah, but if you really knew me and you knew how I responded to my wife this morning and you knew the thoughts that went in my head about those people, you wouldn't think I'm so impressive anymore. Mm-hmm. Those people that mentor you, that mentored me, they knew me. So then when I hit my holes and they were like, you look me in the eye, young man, you are a man of God. You are someone that really has the call of God on his life. I needed that. Because a lot of people said that, but I was like, thank you, thank you, thank you. You're supposed to say that.
Yeah.
But they were game changers. And that man, Sean, who's my youth pastor, we still meet every other week. Mm-hmm. He's still helping me out. So it's been a game changer for me. All my children know that. That's what we do. So we have mentors for all of our kids. And it's been a big piece of our life. I don't know how people make it without that in their life. Or maybe we look at the stats of our world, they don't.
Well, I can tell you how they make it, because I had a similar background, alcoholic father, but we lived in poverty. Did you, or was that not an issue?
No, we were in poverty. My parents might say we were lower middle class, but there were times when we didn't know where our next meal was coming from.
Sure.
And I still remember going, and our water and electricity was turned off, and I had to go get a big popcorn can and take water from the neighbors and fill it up. And then we would
try. You were the firstborn.
I was firstborn, so I'm like 10 years old, filling up these things with water, trying to find a way to heat them up so that our brothers could take baths and stuff. So it wasn't always that way. We had a fighting spirit inside of us, but it was pretty hard.
Or when you said, you know, I don't know how people live that way, I think I survived. I don't know that I really lived.
That's a good way.
Early on, growing up.
I agree.
I read a book a few years ago called The Cure, and I use this statement a lot. It's called, and it sounds like you've experienced this, so let me ask you the question.
Okay.
What if there was a place so safe that the worst of you could be known, and you would discover that you would not be loved less, but actually more in the telling of it? Did you get that?
Oh, man. That ministers deeply to my soul.
It sounds like you received that from some men who chose to mentor you.
I did.
Okay.
I did, and I think that idea of safety, I mean, in Alcoholics Anonymous, when my dad would go, he would get better at times. I went to AA meetings, and you hear statements like, the worse your story, the warmer your welcome. Mm. I think sometimes addicts catch this a lot more than the rest of us who are trying to get all of our junk together and put it together. And so those men were places where I didn't have to have it together. The worse my story, the warmer my welcome. So I did experience that. I think that life, though, knocks that out of you and doesn't make you feel safe, because you're trying to be a good dad, you're trying to be a good husband, you're trying to be on. And so it's been in the last few years, I've had to re-up on that all over again. Who are the people of whom I have zero secrets with? Mm-hmm. Because if I'm not fully known, I can't be fully loved. If I'm not fully loved, I won't walk in all God has for me and what others have for me. So I'm relearning it all over again.
Okay.
I'm thankful for the investment of those men. And I'm saying men. There's been women as well that, while it wasn't that same accountability maybe all the time, various people all across the way, especially my mom, but others as well that were key people that invested in my life. And I'm just eternally grateful. And when I get to heaven, I'm sure they're getting lots of applause from Jesus. They're sitting a lot closer to him than I will be. I'll be like, but I will be singing their praises. I'm very grateful. They'll have a lot of crowns.
It's called the ripple effect.
Yeah.
You know, you throw the pebble in the water.
Right.
And so it's interesting. This lady, Mercedes?
Mercedes.
Mentored your mom. It's very deliberate.
Very deliberate.
And did she spend one-on-one time with you as much?
No.
But look what she did with your mom, how it impacted you and your brothers.
That's right. As a matter of fact, when I started to get serious about this girl named Blair that I was dating, and maybe I guess I had just, either I just proposed or mom knew I was going to propose to Blair, she said, you need to come to this Bible study with me on Tuesday nights. And so my wife started to go to that Bible study, and it's just straight study from the Word of God. Mm. Everybody has an Amplified Bible. Everybody's doing fill in the blanks. And my wife still looks at her Amplified Bible to this day. Mm. And so my mom started pulling her into Mercedes' teaching and started to get close to her. And anyway, my wife had her own set of mentors and always has and still does. And so you're right. Not a lot of one-on-one personally, but those Mercedes set off a ripple effect that my family is eternally grateful for. It's kind of that It's a Wonderful Life moment, you know, where the guy gets a chance to go see what his life was like had he not been there. That's what I look back at. I'm like, without those mentors, that movie would be a horror movie of where the gullies were going to go apart from the grace of God and the people that he put around us to be bookends so that we didn't go off the rails. We tried to. Lord knows we tried.
Yeah. Wow.
So grateful for that in our life.
Okay.
The wheels are turning.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Okay, so we heard you teach in the last few months. Mm-hmm. As we watched it and listened to it again, there were some things that resonated with us, and that's why we wanted to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm honored.
Yeah. I'm gonna make read a couple of statements.
Okay.
That you shared in this message when you taught a few months ago.
Yeah.
And let's just take it from there.
Well, we keep referring to this message in the link. I'll put a link
excellent.
To your message so people can actually hear the whole thing.
True.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So how to create a non-anxious presence in our world. And you say here, peace takes place on the soul level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, take it from there for us.
Well, it's kind of comical that y'all are asking me this question. I mean, your listeners don't know me. I mean, first of all, you have to realize a lot of times people think when you start using phrases like peace, shalom, non-anxious presence, they assume that you're just a hermit-like monk who just really has very limited problems and you don't live in our real world.
Well, the robe you're wearing, that sends that message.
That's exactly right.
I'm just kidding. He's not wearing a robe.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But that's what people think. So you have to understand, my personality is a hard-charging type A. I used to say, even when we started our church, it was like we were a bunch of Navy SEALs. Sleep is for wimps. You do that in heaven. None of us retire. You know, I prided myself. I didn't know I prided myself on running 19-hour days and sleeping 4 to 5 hours and get up and work out and spend time with God and get up your kids and run and coach all these teams and do all this stuff. And so you have to understand, people who have known me for a long time, they don't quite know what to do with me now, because when I kind of hit this tough moment in my life in 2019 to 21, when I reemerged, I was using phrases like non-anxious presence, and they were like, who is this guy? Because we're used to you being up in front and being loud and telling us what to do and being excited and running these events. And so I remember being at a lower spot, I guess it was 2021, and I was at a point where I was like, if I pray, it doesn't work. If I read the Bible, it doesn't work. Any spiritual trick I do, and I know a lot of them, it doesn't work.
What was your role at the time?
At the time, I was an associate pastor at our church in Waco.
Yeah, I'd like people to pay attention to that statement. Mm-hmm. It's not about a title or position you're in that you have these things.
No. No, and again, we got a great church and a great people and, you know, great team, and everybody's checking on me, but I just kept telling them something's not right. We were actually growing and seeing a lot of amazing things that maybe a lot of pastors, leaders want to aspire to, but I was eroding emotionally on the inside. I was waking up every morning at 3 a.m. I was having panic attacks all the time, relational chaos everywhere. Mm. Like, I just was like, what is going on?
What do you mean relational chaos?
I mean that there was a lot of conflict and tension, a lot of what people dealt with in 2020 and 2021, whether it was racial tension. We our church is, at that time, was one-third non-white. So there's a lot of racial opinions in our church, and these people are like friends and close to me, and they walk close with me. I walk close with them. There was political tensions because of all that was going on with the elections. There was a lot of opinions about that. You really got to the point where you'd wake up every day and be like, who am I going to tick off today? Mm. Like, who is going to be, and then what is the, and then what a lot of people don't even maybe realize is it wasn't just what was going on with COVID and the epidemic and all of that. People's lives were just falling apart apart from the sickness.
Sure.
Like, I had a list on my phone of 8 crises that if I read those to you, your anxiety would spike through the roof. And these were people that I was checking with every day who have had a kid murdered, who have had, you know, a daughter prodigal, a husband leaving them, a sexual addiction. Like, these people that I'm walking with, and my world's emotionally eroding, and some of my closest friends, it feels like there's tensions. And I was just like, I don't know how to make it anymore. Speaking of, you know, you talk about being a survivor, Chris. At one point, someone told me, Carl, a lot of times people who grew up in addiction, they're so used to chaos, they make great leaders later because they know what to do in chaos. Mm. They have a sixth muscle that they just kick into, and when others might crater, they're like, well, welcome to my world. This is a Tuesday. This is just normal. And you have been able to run for about 25, 30 years with more coping mechanisms, with more grace, with more strength. And a lot of that was God's power, but a lot of that also, I would say in 2020 and 21, it's like the water levels went over what my coping mechanisms could handle, and it collapsed. And a lot of my family of origin issues started to come to the surface. A lot of my own internal issues I didn't even know I had started to come to the surface. And I wouldn't say it was sin necessarily. I would say it was old wounds, things I thought were healed. I just recently heard about a Thomas Keating quote that he says that when you go into solitude, you have to first unload the unconscious. I think that's what was going on. There was a lot under the surface that I didn't know was there, and it started to collapse.
How did it manifest itself?
Well, I started to see it first in my body. Like, literally, I would get around certain people or certain scenarios, or I knew I was walking to a meeting where someone's mad at me, and my heart was just racing, my mind was spinning. And there were times I had a hard time breathing. Like, I'd have to go for a walk around my neighborhood, get it together, and then make a phone call or come back together. I literally was up every morning at 3 a.m. I didn't sleep but a couple hours here or there. And so, of course, that erodes. Your sleep erodes, and it's downhill from there. I mean, it's just the ability for me to function was not there. And
people still have expectations of you.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it was kind of like my world was getting worse and worse and worse, and more was being demanded of me. Mm. And so, and again, at that time, too, my family was full throttle. There's a lot going on there, and I want to be a present father and a present husband. And my wife is a champion, and she, you know, gave me a lot of grace and held me up and loved me. But I just have a lot more higher standards for myself, and I just couldn't get there. And I kept cracking. And I was like, this is not going well. I went to a 3-week intensive for pastors and missionaries. And one of the first days we're there, they show you these two stick figures. And in one stick figure, there was an arrow pointing to the head and then down. And it said, this is the way most of us in our evangelical Christianity world have worked. And it's the way most of the world works. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get teaching, and then you embody it. You hear that, and you know, that's good. I want to figure out how to do that, mm-hmm. whether you're a God follower or not. That's the way it all comes in. Mm-hmm. Until you hit a wall, and you hit a place where your emotions and your insight, they're not progressing due to either tragedy, due to compassion fatigue, due to burnout, due to your own sinful blowout, kind of like David did in the Bible. Like whatever that scenario is, where it's, and I'm not talking, so this is not like I had a bad day and,
right.
you know what I mean? I didn't get into the sorority I was hoping to get into.
Right.
This is like a different, deeper, you know, what St. John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul.
Where a good night's sleep doesn't take care of it.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Where naps aren't working. Mm-hmm. Good night's sleep, a little, and actually I tried to take some time off of work and that didn't work mm-hmm. because basically, that doesn't heal the anxiety that's going on inside of me that I don't know I have, the unconscious stuff.
And growing up in the home of an alcoholic, did you have a mindset that, oh, tomorrow will be better or I can push through this and I'll be just fine?
Well, yes, because
I did.
Yes, and that's also, and this is a good, what I'm about to say is a good thing. I come from, in my spirituality, I come from a little bit more of the Pentecostal world, and I love that.
Mm-hmm.
That world loves the book, the Gospel of Mark, because the word immediately is about 16 times done. It's like, Jesus did this, immediately. Jesus did this. So if you'll line up with Scripture and you'll hear the right thing, mm-hmm. then immediately this will happen. And I live in that mentality. I'm like going, well, if I'm honoring God, if I'm honoring others, if I'm doing, I can't, there's no sin in my life that's like, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a sinner, but it's nothing glaring. There should be some immediately. There's a breakthrough coming. So mm-hmm. I just need to keep declaring it. I need to keep moving forward. And the more I did that, I felt like my tires were grinding in the mud and I can't get better.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it was like a crisis of belief, like, wait a minute, what's going on? And when I saw that second stick figure, the arrow was coming at the guts.
Mm.
It was like right at your inner woman, inner man. And it was like, but when you hit that place, something's going to have to come on the inside and flood you from down deep up to your head. Mm. And it's going to come a different way. So it's probably not going to be you plowing through your disciplines. It's going to be release control, let go, and see where God takes you. And so during that time, I start hearing this phrase, non-anxious presence. I didn't know what to do with that. I was like, that is everything I am not.
Mm.
But man, I was around it. The gentleman who, I think the gentleman who coined that phrase might have been Dallas Willard.
Okay.
He's gone to be with Jesus, pastor, author, philosopher, USC. Mm-hmm. He had discipled and mentored for about 10 to 15 years, a man named Bill Galtier. And Bill Galtier had begun to walk with me in this time. One of those 3 a.m.s, I woke up, and I don't recommend doing this, but on that morning, I woke up and checked my email.
Mm.
And I had received I had received a book, this, and I just wanted to get my mind off of the anxiety that were going through my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I started reading this book called Journey of the Soul. And he began to talk about what God's doing in you when his felt presence is removed and when you feel like you're at that wall.
Mm.
And I called him. He actually met with me.
Wow.
And began to meet with me and invite me into these retreats that he would do, where he'd talk about how Dallas Willard had mentored him for 15 years and that he had never met anyone who was a non-anxious presence like Dallas Willard.
Wow.
And then I would, and of course I'm a pastor. Well, give me the 3 C's of how he does that.
Yeah.
The 4 A's, give me the quick one pager. And he was like, it's not the way it works.
Mm.
And I watched Bill, he's just like me, driven, go-getter, do it. And I was like, but you don't carry, even though you're carrying a worldwide ministry and a lot on your shoulders, and you're carrying me, and you carry it with this light and easy yoke that people like me, we read those verses, but they don't make a lot of sense. And I was like, I want that. I want that non-anxious presence. And so he began to talk to me and help me experience that. So hopefully I'm experiencing that to new levels, but it came through a crisis place.
Mm-hmm. As most beautiful things do, right?
Most beautiful things start with ashes before they go to beauty.
Gosh, yeah.
And a lot of that had to do with me releasing that control, and it's the hardest place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of myself as a control freak, and people don't use that word typically to describe me, but when your outer world starts falling apart, you just start trying to put it together. And when it doesn't, only thing you can do is go to your inner world and be like, okay, well, I can't control that relationship, this election. I can't control the way that person's going to handle this leadership thing. I can't. And so the ability to consistently be like, okay, Lord, I release that to you.
Mm.
And of course, I know that at one level, but at the soul level, at the deep place, have I sat still long enough to truly unplug like a boat with no oars and say, I'm going to watch that go. Mm-hmm. And to get to that place where I truly could be like, I don't know what's going to happen with my life, with my finances, with my relationships. I don't know if I'll even go back into ministry. I don't know anything. And I thought I'd know more at 48 years old, not less. Mm. So then when you're at that place to be able to say, that was a long, slow process. And every day I'd wake up and pray this old prayer from an ancient French man that was above all trust in the slow work of God. Mm. And I would just say, today I will trust in the slow work of God. This is not immediately. I'm all for immediately. Mm-hmm. I love immediately. I hope it happens immediately. Mm. But that's not the muscle that God was strengthening. He was kind of like he was saying, you've done a good job with your arms, but you have chicken legs. You have missed leg day for a long time. And so your leg day is you're going to trust in the slow work of God. Let him come in and totally come to the point where you can release to me so that you can be a non-anxious presence. Mm. So that when I walk into situations and people's tensions are rising, my kids' tensions or whatever it is, I don't enmesh myself, which is a very common children of alcoholics issue, to be enmeshed, but instead to say, this is where I start, I stop, you start, and I don't have to let your contagious tensions and anxiety rub off on me. I have something on the inside that I'm able to walk in, and I'm learning that. I'm a few years in. I feel like a toddler, but I'm getting better at tying my shoes today.
I have a question you said earlier, none of the spiritual tricks were working. Do you have spiritual tricks now?
I do, but again, forgive me if I quote Dallas Willard too much, but you mentioned the ripple effect. Him investing in Bill and Bill and me pestering Bill at every retreat and asking him a million questions. And to this day, he's in California. I email him all the time. Basically, Dallas Willard wrote a book called The Spirit of the Disciplines. Mm. It was to kind of counter Richard Foster's Celebration of the Discipline to say, if you get these disciplines down and you think the goal is to be good at the disciplines, you will miss the disciplines. Mm. Because Jesus actually is not trying to get us to be good prayers, to be good Bible readers, to be good Sabbath takers. And so oftentimes if you're talking to someone, you'll be like, how is your faith going? They'll be like, well, I haven't been to church in a while. I'm not a good church goer.
Right.
So Willard's thing was the second you make the discipline the end instead of the means, you have made it, it will die. Mm-hmm. It will shrivel up and you'll actually feel as an obligation and you'll hate it. And so a lot of my process was trying not to, how do I do this without trying, because I'm also a one on the Enneagram, I want to get better at everything. So I'm like, great, I'll be great. I was good at times with God and fasting and maybe generosity or discipleship. Now I'm going to be good at stillness and solitude and I'm just going to be good at the next thing. And I heard a gentleman say, I hope what you don't do is exchange one set of tricks for the other set of tricks. Because if you do, you'll just do the same thing. You'll kill all those disciplines. Mm-hmm. So now I would say that those, I need the places of silence and solitude, stillness and Sabbath, those four S's. Those are practices that were not in my life before that are in my life now. Mm-hmm. But I think that the quote trick, if you say it that way, is it's really, this sounds so simple and I'm still developing language for this. I am learning how to bring my whole self to God. Mm. That is the trick. It is not to let anything, like, not to come and just be like, here I am, God, let's do this together, but pause and go, well, what is really going on inside of me?
You don't think you did that in the past?
I think I did it to the best I knew how. Mm-hmm. And I'm a very vulnerable person, so if you want to know my sins, I'll tell you right now. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I'm emotionally aware of what's going on.
Okay.
And I think I learned there's a difference between me being vulnerable about what's going on in my life, my sin, my mind, and then what's going on emotionally. So again, in one of these little settings, they made us hold out our hand and say mad, sad, bad, glad, scared. Most of us can bring our emotions and our experiences down to those five words. Or what's irritating us, mad, what's sad, what's some grievances that we have. Bad, where's some shame that we carry? Glad, what are those? This is like the Psalms almost. And then scared, what are you fearful of? I could answer those really quickly, but if you just made me pause and say, well, right now, what's going on inside of you? I'd be like, I don't know. So, I mean, I was driving to Oklahoma today, pausing on, Lord, what is there anything under the surface I'm not aware of? Where am I sat? And I went straight to, back to non-anxious presence. I woke up this morning, and I woke up to a text. I shouldn't have looked at my phone. But the first text I looked at was from someone I love that's telling me a decision they're about to make that was very difficult for me to hear. And it's funny because my wife and I were talking a couple of days ago. It was one of those moments where we were like, everything's going great. The kids are doing well. We've had some big breakthroughs in some different ways. We're like, it's all going well, you know. Then I woke up to this. So it's easy to be peaceful 2 days ago when everything is great. But I woke up to that. And I'm just to be honest, my next move was I just pulled up my news app and started trying to distract my mind and read about the Oscars or whatever. Like, I just wanted to distract my mind with what's going on.
I understand that.
Because I don't want to feel that. And that's what came to my mind. Like, you distracted yourself until you could get your coffee and distract yourself further with your wonderful coffee. So I was literally driving here going, I missed a chance to just say, God, if that conversation happens, that decision gets made by that person, that is going to have ramifications that I'm going to experience. I am scared about that. And I can just kind of, you can kind of feel the Heavenly Father going, what makes you scared about that? And so I wasn't, me bringing my whole self to him and letting him just love me and be there. And again, it's sometimes it's hard to put into language, but unless I'm able to really pause and identify what's going on under the surface that I'm not aware of, then most likely I'm walking into every meeting today, every situation I'm in, and I'm carrying all this, but I don't know that I am. And most people, if they've been following, especially if they've been following God for a while, they know that if they're stuck somehow, they'll pray the prayer of David, test me, Lord, is there any sin in me that needs to be moved, removed? And but a lot of times I find it's not sin. It's like it's grief we're carrying, we don't know we're carrying. It's irritation we're carrying, we don't know we're carrying. It's those anxieties. So I try to pause, move a little slower, be aware of that, bring that to God. It doesn't make me like, and now I'm all better. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, I think now I'm more loved. And if I'm more loved, perfect love cast out fear, I can move a little bit more confidently.
I used to struggle with this. I think we did it together as well. But Christina battled anxiety really in deep ways years ago. And I'd say, well, how are you today? And I would say, I would ask it with an uptone, how are you today? hoping she'd say, oh, I'm good. I'm how great. Are you? And she'd say, I'm not doing good. And I allowed it to dictate my day, right? Yeah. Or she'd say, I'm good. I'm okay. Well, good. I would grab a hold of any positive I heard there, and it was a lie for both of us many times. We knew we were doing it, but we kind of were not aware of what we were doing, too.
That's right.
Do you follow me?
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, so we spend our whole day living in a facade.
That's right.
And we're people who are pretty transparent.
Yeah.
In the past, before what'd you call it, the dark?
Dark night of the soul.
When people who know you would ask you, Carl, how are you doing? How would you have answered in the past compared to how you would ask now? Or rather respond.
If I was in a small group setting where people really wanted to know, if I was in small group setting and I was around a few of my other pastors on staff, I'd be more real. I'd be like, hey guys, I'm dying on the inside. I need your help. But if they were like, what's going on? I'd be like, I don't even know. The hard part for me is I had all these close friends I was in small groups with, and a lot of my tensions were about people in our church or on our staff, and I couldn't tell them.
Sure.
So I was bottling up a lot. And even though I'm a very verbose person, Lord, God bless my wife. She has had to listen to me talk for 25 years, you know. But I would come home from work and I didn't want to talk. And she would say, what happened in that meeting? And I'd be like, please don't make me talk about this. Tell me about your day. I'd love to hear everything, you know. And so typically it depended on my setting, but typically my answer, if someone said, how are you? A lot of times I'd be like, you know, it's tough, but God's good, and we're going to make it. And it was more the positive.
Like a cheerleader.
I'm a coach at heart. I'm just like, let's go. And again, I don't bash that necessarily because, you know, when you have kids and they're young, you want them to choose joy first. That's one of the things we talk about in our home. We choose joy. Actually, today is Monday. We're recording this on a Monday. Monday is Thankful Monday in the Gully House.
Okay.
The first thing out of our mouth when we all sit down for breakfast is, what's everybody thankful for? Because nobody wants to do Mondays. We're mad we're going to school and mad we're going to work. So let's start with thankfulness. And Gullies choose joy. Mm. We talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. They know I have a list of four things they're looking for in a future spouse. Joyful is one of them.
Huh, okay.
Because life's hard enough. And so make sure that you get someone whose default is joy. Mm-hmm. I think those are great things. But underneath that, maybe one shadow side of that is that if we're choosing joy at the expense, it's like, but if my kids, as they get older, if they're like, no, I'm doing great, Dad. Everything's wonderful. And you're a great dad. But there's actually something between us.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not saying it. The older we get, I need relationship with you much more than I need you to just put on a smile and walk out. I need you to do that in second grade.
Yeah.
But you're a freshman in college now.
Mm.
I need to know what's really going on with you. And it's almost like an imaginary line we cross over and we don't know we have. And we're like, choosing joy works. I still want to choose joy, but I don't know how to be emotionally aware of what's going on. And I'm holding back from God, maybe from others. So it's a relearning to come into a new normal.
Have you ever taken an assessment called emotional intelligence?
Is that a book about your emotional intelligence quotient?
I think so. It's like being aware, like, of your emotions very, very well.
I think I have done that.
Because we have a friend, Phil Reynolds. He has his own company, and that's what he does. Hmm. And I was in one of his seminars a few years ago. And so he's been on our podcast a couple of times. But as you talk about that, you can be an older person, very mature,
yes,
very developed, educated, and not be emotionally aware or absolutely intelligent in some ways, right?
Absolutely. Pete Scazzaro is probably the guru of this in our world today, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality.
Oh, one of our favorite books.
And y'all remember in his foreword to that book, he says, I'm sorry, the subtitle of that book is, it is impossible to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature.
Yeah.
In the introduction to the book, he makes the comment that most people who say I've been a Christian for 20 years, it's not true.
Yeah.
You've been a Christian for 1 year, 20 times.
Mm.
And his whole thing is, because if the glacier analogy is correct, and there is more going underneath the surface than we recognize, the problem is we've not been trained to recognize what's going on under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to applaud the team of people that I've worked with for so many years. We do a lot of work on that side, but I think when tensions hit, a lot of the stuff from my past started to come up. And I mentioned my dad's an alcoholic. God's restored my dad. He restored my parents. My dad and I are very close. We're season ticket holders for Baylor basketball games. Mm-hmm. We don't miss one. We go to every one together. Every time we talk, he tells me he loves me and he's proud of me. So there, I thought, because it's all restored,
right?
And actually, in our neck of the woods in Waco, Texas, and beyond, everybody wants us to tell this story.
Mm.
Everybody wants to see the video of my dad's it rocks people. I do prison ministry now. Dad comes with me. He tells that story. Everybody's in tears. Mm. Like, so I thought, it's resurrection. We've come to the other side. And my friend Bill, who's counseling me, mentoring me, he says, he kept asking all these questions. I was like, please stop asking me about my daddy issues. Like, I dealt with those. We're good. And he's like, no. What I'm trying to say is during those years, your relationships could be healed, but ruts could have developed about the way you deal with conflict, tension, anxiety, struggles. And as a result, you don't know what to do with that stuff.
Yeah.
And that was hard to hear, and I knew he was right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in a leaders meeting last week, and I told them, I said, hey, just so you know, I need y'all to know that I walked into this meeting knowing I'm carrying a lot of stress with me. And so y'all may feel that from me while we're talking about what we're going to talk about today, because it's very sensitive information.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be confused, like, what's Carl thinking? We can't tell. It's because I know I'm bringing all this stuff in. That's big, big for me.
To be aware of that.
To be aware.
And then be able to express
it. And to tell them I'm carrying that. And actually, I have kind of an inner critic. I'm on my own case all the time. And so some things that y'all said, y'all probably said them at a 2. I heard them at an 8.
Mm.
Just because my own inner critic is like a megaphone. You probably didn't say it that way. That's the way I heard it. Here's what I heard is, and so I'm having to out loud say these dynamics. it's embarrassing. You're just kind of like, can I just be a normal human? But you get to the point where you're like, I don't think normal's working. And these different people who are around me, we have decades of relationships, so they smile and they go, we love you, buddy. And so I'm just learning, if I don't name it, I can't actually get any victory in it. And I think that's what's hopefully leading to some of that inner peace. There's a quote I just heard recently from an ancient Russian saint. It was, if you will acquire the spirit of peace, then 1,000 souls around you will be saved.
Wow.
Acquire the spirit of peace, 1,000 souls around you will be saved. I'm getting more convinced of that all the time as our world's falling apart. People are looking for people to be a non-anxious presence, to walk in and everything's not going right. Doesn't mean everything's going right. It just means that we know how to walk in peace in the midst of that. So that's what I'm kind of leaning into.
If somebody's listening today and they're like, ooh,
we hope somebody is listening.
Yeah. Hopefully somebody.
I resonate with what you're saying. Do you have a couple of takeaways? Like, I don't know. I'm not aware of what's under the surface. Yeah. What would be some takeaways?
Yeah. Well, welcome to humanity. And it's okay that you are a human and you are trying to learn these things. And maybe if you're not familiar, then what I'm saying sounds sage level, but I listen to a lot of people who I feel like they are at another level, and just start where you are. Mm-hmm. If I was sitting with someone, I would have them hold their five fingers up right now. And I would say mad, sad, bad, glad, scared. And then we would sit in like 30 to 60 seconds about mad. Where are you mad? Where are you irritated? Sad, where are you disappointed? And I'd just say, go through each of these. You know, these are not bad. We're taught that, like you were talking about earlier, about joy is a good emotion and anger is a bad emotion. But if you just see it more like it's neutral, like they're maybe unpleasant, but they're not bad. So just what are they? I would teach people how to identify what they're feeling. Mm-hmm. And just to be very emotionally honest with God and with a safe person. Mm-hmm. I had a life-changing experience, and maybe it was 22. My wife and I were invited to go to a Benedictine monastery with this very famous Christian who was leading it. And we didn't really know much about this famous Christian except that everybody in the world right now is talking about him. If I said his name, everybody knows who this person is. And so we go to this monastery, and they started by taking us in to the Benedictine monk prayer time. I had no idea what was going on. Hmm. This lady finally, no one greets us. They don't greet us. No one says welcome. They just start singing their mantras and going into, have you ever been in this setting?
No.
And they're like, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I'll be lifted up in the earth. This kind of mantra. And they're just, this woman runs up to a group of us. She can tell like 20 of us, 40 of us walked in. And she starts giving us some prayer books. And I'm trying to flip through. I don't even know where they are. And then they sing. And I'm kind of start laughing because they.
That sounds appropriate.
It was not appropriate. But I looked over at the leader and he was cracking up. So I started laughing. Mm. And then my wife, this has been the story of my life. I'm always laughing at inappropriate times. And now my wife is like, shut up, you know? And I'm like, I can't. And the reason is they're singing Psalm 140. I don't have that memorized.
Wow.
But it's like, put venom in their mouth, oh God. May my enemies' heads be dashed against the rocks.
Oh my.
Selah. And I had never heard that in a church. And it just cracked me up. They're just singing it to God. They don't greet us. They don't say even, they just walked out. When the monks got done, they turn and they walk out. And I thought, this is not the American church, because if you don't greet people and make them feel loved and give them a cup of coffee and take them to your guest room and give them a coffee cup and a pen, they're not coming back. And we asked the leader afterwards, and he's like, well, we weren't here for you.
Wow.
He's like, he actually said it was a performance for God is what he said. And we have a bad connotation about performance, but yeah. He didn't. He was like, we were there for God. Y'all just walked in on it.
And that's humbling.
Oh, we were all kind of like, oh, right. Mm-hmm. That's what we were thinking. You know, we weren't thinking that. And then I turned to the leader and I said, have you ever prayed a prayer so honest? And I said, it just dawned on me, God did not correct David. That David said, let their heads be dashed against the rocks, put venom in their mouth, God. Mm-hmm. Selah. Pause and think about that.
Yeah.
And God didn't correct him. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's all I could think about the whole time we were in there. And I turned to my wife and I said, I'm not that emotionally honest. Mm. So to your question about what I would tell people, I would help them identify what's going on and then be emotionally honest with God. It doesn't give you a justification to go act out and an excuse to go to say, oh, this is my excuse for why I get to go sin. But it does help me understand. I think most of our wickedness probably does come from our wounds and our weariness. And so if we could just identify what that is, emotionally honest, with emotional honesty, bring that to God and just go, Lord, this is just me. Could you just come wrap your arms around all of me? And I think that'd be where I'd say start.
I love that. We grew up in an expression of church that was a little bit more structured and
legalistic.
Okay, it was legalistic. I was trying to be sweet. It was legalistic.
I had my foot in one of those streams as well.
And I remember hearing somebody who'd walked out alongside with us when we found language for what does it mean to really understand the Holy Spirit and have the full gospel and not just, you know, all these. Anyway, he said, you know, I always knew God loved me. I just didn't think he ever liked me.
Exactly.
And so I operated way too long. And as you're sharing this, I remember we were overseas this past summer. And I was reading in the Psalms, and I read something where David says, God, I give you my whole heart. And I just heard the Holy Spirit say, I dare you to give me your whole heart. I was like, I can do that. And I'm a visual person, so I drew a cute little heart. And he goes, write everything that's in it. Oh, love for my family, love. He goes, I'm so glad. But what else is in there? Well, we had gotten an email about something with the minister. I was like, that's in there. He said, but how do you feel about it? I said, if I'm honest, I'm disappointed you haven't taken care of that. And instead of thinking, he's going to whack me. I felt so known and so loved, and it changed everything.
When I told my brother back in Waco about that experience at the monastery, he told me, he said something, and it paired with, because a month before that or so, I had been with my friend Bill, and I remember him saying, let's just have a time where you just tell God what you really think. And I was like, okay. He's like, go for it. And he's like, actually, why don't you just look at me? Like, just keep your eyes open. Don't be too spiritual. Just look at me. I'm not God, but just kind of look at, and just start talking. And I was like, okay. And he's like, because I feel like you've got some disappointment with God. And I was like, I do. He's like, well, just say it out loud. I'm like, okay, well, God, I feel disappointed. You didn't come through in some places you said you were going to, but it's okay. I know you're a good God. Your arm is not too short to save. You're going to come through, but it's frustrating to have to live in this for so long because your word promises differently. But I understand that you will come through. He stopped me. He goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. You are, I can tell you're a pastor. You just pastored Jesus.
Wow.
He's like,
and he doesn't need that.
He doesn't really need your pastoring. He's like, try that again. I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Again, I am, at that time, I'm 46 years old. And I'm like, I feel like I'm just being reduced to a child, which is how Jesus told us to come to him. But I just felt clueless. So fast forward, I come back from the monastery and I tell my brother. And he says, I've just come to the point in my life where I realize if I have to babysit God's emotions, he's not God.
Wow.
And that statement just, it was like a stone just went inside me. If I have to babysit God's emotions, he's not God. And he's like, I think, and he was saying, I'm learning to bring all of me to God because God doesn't pull back from me. He can handle this. He actually created this. And I needed all of those experiences with Bill at the monastery and with my brother to put that together. And when I came to the end of an extended sabbatical where I was trying to really flesh this stuff out with God and others, I remember my leadership team came to me and said, what'd you learn in your sabbatical? And I said, you know, I am actually convinced God enjoys me and I can trust him. And my wife leaned over. She's like, you might want to say something deeper than that. I mean, surely... in all your years of ministry and following God, you kind of knew that. And I was like, I did, at least at the conceptual level. But I don't know at the deep soul level, I operate it from a place of, he enjoys me, and I can just trust him. And of course, I have to contend for that and walk in that level of peace that's not always easy to get to. But when you get there, whew, It's a beautiful place.
Gosh, this is good.
Good stuff. Yeah. You know, we hardly covered anything on our notes, and that's totally fine.
I'm glad.
It's so much better. Anything else?
I don't think so. Carl, thank you for being so honest and so relatable. As always, we're so grateful that you take the time to listen. And I won't say I hope. I know that you got some nuggets today and that the Holy Spirit will just bring you back to some things that Carl said. If today was meaningful to you, share it with somebody else. I think what we did here was not scripted and has some meaning beyond the life of just this recording. And so share it with somebody. If the Holy Spirit has already showed you somebody, then that's who you're supposed to share it with. So as always, we just want to thank you for listening to Real Life Mentoring Podcast.